You're listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. 2022 saw a long list of major climate-related disasters: massive flooding in Pakistan, an extensive drought in the Horn of Africa, and a devastating hurricane in the Caribbean, to name a few. These kinds of events often take an outsized toll on communities who are already impacted by challenges like conflict, food insecurity, or social marginalization. I'm Claire Doyle, and in today's episode, I've collaborated with Elsa Barron from the Center for Climate and Security to look at how young people around the world are finding ways to enact change in the face of this reality, and what next steps they think are most important. The episode is a set of conversations with two young leaders who work at the intersection of climate, justice, and peace, Christian Zakor and Hassan Moulay Yassin. We'll hear first from Christian, a young environmentalist from Trinidad and Tobago, who is doing work with UNEP's major group for children and youth, and then we'll turn to a conversation with Hassan, who is the co-founder and vice executive director of Somali Greenpeace Association. Christian, thank you so much for joining today. It's so wonderful to have you. You've been really deeply involved in climate and environmental work for a while. You've worked with groups like the Caribbean Philanthropic Alliance and the TNT Climate Network, and you currently serve as the Small Island Developing States Facilitator with UNEP's Major Group for Children and Youth. You're also an environmental writer and communicator, and you spoke at COP27 in Egypt this past November. So could you start by sharing what drew you to this kind of work and then speak a bit to your current role at UNEP?
I've always had a passion for environment. It actually started when I was 7 years old and I found an encyclopedia that had a chapter on extinct animals, and that really kickstarted my interest in environment and conservation. And I've taken a largely academic approach, but being involved in a lot of volunteer groups, like the Major Group of Children and Youth, it's given me an appreciation for the independence and grassroots angle as well. I forgot the second part of your question.
About your work at UNEP.
Well, I need to explain first the major group system. I don't work in UNEP. I just volunteer within the Major Group of Children and Youth to UNEP. So the major groups are an independent, self-organized way for people to engage to the United Nations. So we are associated with UNEP, but we aren't really working for. What we do in UNEP MGCY is we engage young people in sort of campaigning for policy and governance within UNEP. But of course, many of the other UN bodies also have MGCYs, like YOUNGO, which is the major group to the UNFCCC, and there's many others.
Yeah, thank you so much for clarifying that and sharing a bit about what that looks like. Could you elaborate a little bit on how you're mobilizing youth in this space and interacting with UNEP?
It's very much online. So the major group of children and youth to UNEP, actually, it was on hiatus up until around 2019. And then it was restarted in late 2019, just before the pandemic. So it was really well placed to benefit from people who were suddenly in lockdown, like myself. That's when I got involved. And we function by using working groups on thematic areas. And we have thematic coordinators and regional coordinators. I'm a regional coordinator for SIDS. And it really depends on what projects come in or assignments from UNEP. For example, we might host our own webinars on capacity building to educate young people. Or we also support people to attend negotiations such as the CPR Committee of Permanent Representatives, which it's kind of like the administrative part of negotiations for UNEP. And most recently, we coordinated the Stockholm Plus 50 Youth Task Force, which I'm sure we're going to talk about later. But we were able to get together around a good many people, I think like 50-something young people who came together to create a youth handbook, a policy paper, and a timeline of youth activity going back to the 1970s that was supporting the Stockholm Plus 50 conference in June last year. And that's just some of the things that we do.
Thank you. Yeah, that's really important work. And I'm glad that you fleshed out some of the details of what it's looking like day to day. So, you know, young people around the globe are, of course, feeling the impacts of climate change and will feel the impacts far into the future. But I think that there is also a growing recognition that young people aren't just victims, as we're seeing in your work, they're also part of the solution. And so they need to be included in environmental problem solving. So you've been working with young people, as we just heard, and especially young people from SIDS, which we know are particularly hard hit by climate change. You kind of spoke about this a little bit, but what are some of the ways that you're seeing youth actually moving the needle on climate and environmental issues? What are some of the success stories of youth engagement in this space? And Stockholm Plus 50 maybe is a place to start there.
Oh yeah, definitely. So the Stockholm Plus 50 Youth Task Force model, following the conference, where we actually had over 200 registered delegates, young people who registered the delegates and were able to attend, some of us with funding, like the Swedish government actually provided some people with funding to attend, which is great because they were actively trying to get people to come to this monumental conference. There was, I think it was the UNGA a few months after, they were celebrating the model because they realized it was so effective at getting people involved. And I think it was particularly impactful because the Stockholm conference was not your typical negotiated conference like the COP27. It was much more chill because there weren't any political agendas to uphold, and the government representatives who came were able to talk quite candidly about what needs to be done. Of course, we can't really expect to see that being upheld because of our political agendas, but it was still reassuring to have that.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that model and how it was kind of lauded, or maybe as seen as something that could be expanded to other realms.
I think there's also the now, I need to speak candidly about this part. I don't always agree with the disruptive model. We've seen activists coming out of groups like Extinction Rebellion and Fridays for Future. And citizens of every country have a right to free speech. And I will 100% support that because it's a fundamental human right to be able to speak and protest and demand things that you know are correct. It's just that sometimes it gets out of hand. I've mentioned the tomato soup protests a few times because I feel like I actually mentioned this when I was talking on the peace building panels in COP. I feel like that represented the culmination of a lot of stress and angst that people are feeling that they're not seeing anything being done. So they resort to this drastic move to deface a painting. I mean, there's a lot that can be said about it. Like, this painting was not particularly important. They use tomato soup and then glue their hands. It's not the most impactful thing, but it was still, it went viral because they got the attention that was needed. But I don't always agree with that. You see those kind of tactics being used by some vegan activists who will, they don't do anything that's particularly disruptive to the status quo. They just inconvenience people. And I don't agree with that. But I do acknowledge that activism comes from a place of passion, and sometimes there really is no other way to get your voice out.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that, you know, that can be kind of a last resort or a result of not having other meaningful ways to engage. And I think that, and it brings us nicely to another question, which is, you know, there's always more work to be done. What are you seeing as some of the obstacles that you think still get in the way of youth being able to fully engage meaningfully in environmental decisions? Or how do you think that the environmental community can be even more inclusive of youth perspectives in environmental problems?
To start with, young people are just a demographic population. There's also the skill-based populations, because the environmental issues are cross-cutting. And we see that with climate change. You have so many different disciplines that come together to talk about environmental issues and social issues and financial issues as well, economic. And they're all intersecting. And I don't really agree with saying the environmental community can be inclusive, because it's such a big, I don't really have the words. It's just a lot of people who are in this, but I can say that an obstacle that I can definitely talk about is tokenism. When young people are invited to talk and it's just treated as ticking off a box, we'll just give them this concession, they'll shut up after. That's not productive and it sets back development. There's also an issue that I myself am fighting with right now, and that's meaningful employment to save the environment. And again, this comes back to the environment being such a cross-cutting field. I have a master's degree in biodiversity conservation, sustainable development in the Caribbean from the University of the West Indies. That could predispose me to work in climate finance, to work in island conservation, but it's hard to find those jobs right now. We need more green jobs. I'm sure there's many other issues, but those are the obstacles that I could talk about, but those are just the ones that come to mind.
Yeah, I think the idea of having employment opportunities for people who are really passionate about this, who are young, who are starting off their careers, is a really important piece of the puzzle. So I kind of want to switch gears a little bit and talk about SIDS in particular. During COP at a side event, you spoke about some of the intersecting environmental and social challenges that your country, Trinidad and Tobago, has faced. And you shared this really poignant quote, which I wanted to share here too. You said, "Peace is not just the absence of conflict, it is the presence of justice." So in light of that framing, which I really like, can you talk a bit about the link between environment and peace in Trinidad and Tobago and other SIDS? And what do you think is missing from the conversation around the link between environment, peace, and justice in these places?
There are a lot of developmental considerations that are shared by many of the Caribbean islands. But Trinidad is set apart because it has such an interesting geological history that we actually have a pretty well-developed mining industry. So if you look at the map of Trinidad, you have the Northern Range, which is, it used to be connected to Venezuela. So that's continental land. But to the south of the Northern Range, you have faults, you have alluvial buildup from the Orinoco River. And we have mining of things like blue limestone, sandstone, quartz, many different minerals. And one of the impacts that we have from that in terms of peace building is illegal mining, where you have contractors who are setting up inside the forest and they'll actually remove enough trees but leave a line by the road so you can't see it from the road. There is a farmer in the central part of Trinidad who has been threatened by contractors trying to mine his land because he's on good land. They're trying to threaten him off of it. And they've done some really nefarious things to get him away. He's complained about it, but there is not much justice that can be accessed right now for him. I have a colleague who works in waste. Her name is Siam. And she actually is quite the role model when it comes to developing your own niche when you can't find a job in the field that you want. And she created this combination of waste education. So she actually regularly runs composting classes, and it's great. And when I was prepping for my panel, I asked her for some input, and she told me sometimes some of the more rural communities in Trinidad, they will burn tires in the road as a way to get attention to their problems. Like they haven't had water in their pipes for weeks, or somebody was just unjustly killed. And she told me that even though the tires are very polluting, that is their way of accessing justice, because they don't feel as though the institution exists and is proactive enough to help them. That's their way of accessing justice, by creating pollution. This is not going to be true for all of the islands in the Caribbean. It's just true for Trinidad.
So it's, you know, always sobering to hear about the challenges that people are facing and some of the ways that these communities have to respond to bring attention to the issues that they're facing. So kind of from there, what are some policies or approaches, either internationally or domestically, that you think could help advance environmental peace building or climate justice in these scenarios?
I think there needs to be an enabling environment. Within the Latin America and Caribbean region, we have an agreement called the Escazo Agreement, which was signed in, you know, I actually can't remember where Escazo is, but it's it stands for the access to public information, access to justice, and defenders of the environment. So that's many countries have not signed on at this point, including my own Trinidad and Tobago. But it's gone into effect now, as of either last year or the year before. And I think it so succinctly sums up the areas that we need to work on. And I think we could be much closer to peace building in the region if the other countries sign on, because access to information, the FOIA law, the Freedom of Information Act, it's not universal. My country has it, and I've been able to use it myself twice, but it's only one of like five Caribbean countries that have it. Access to environmental justice. The environment is so desecrated because we don't know what we have. And it really sucks. And then environmental defenders have been under threat. I would call them an endangered species at this point, because there have been hundreds murdered just for standing up for environmental conservation. So I can't really name any specific policies to use as a case study, but I think that we need to work on the enabling environments. So transparency and accountability. Trinidad actually has a branch of the EITI, the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. And that goes so much further towards creating that enabling environment for the extractive industries in Trinidad, the mining and the oil and gas, to be accountable both on the environmental side of things and also the financials. In fact, I've learned some things about the oil and gas industry in Trinidad that they would not have known otherwise. Things like 95% of mining companies at this point are not registered, but not because they don't want to be, it's because it's so slow to get them registered. They're still operating without a license. It's really messed up. So I think that's what we need to focus on, creating that enabling environment.
Yeah, you know, the Escazú agreement that you mentioned, I know it generated a lot of attention and is seen as kind of a key step in helping protect environmental defenders, which you pointed out are really targeted, and it's been a major issue for a long time, but you know, not getting any better in recent years. So, you know, it's helpful, I think, to end on this note, if not, you know, entirely positive or rosy, a note of kind of forward-looking. What can we do? What has already been proposed that we can build on? So I think it's a great way to wrap up our conversation. So thank you, Christiane, so much for joining. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you and learn more about youth engagement, what you're doing to mobilize youth around environment and peace issues, but also climate justice in SIDS and what you see as being important moving forward. So it sounds like there's reason for optimism, but of course there's still a lot left to be done. And it's really inspiring to see your commitment to this work. So thank you so much for all that you're doing. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
After this conversation with Christiane, I kept thinking about the farmer who was threatened by illegal mining operations and the image of people burning tires along the road just to get institutions to pay attention to their challenges. These stories bring into focus why participation in environmental decision-making is so important, why we need enabling environments, as Christiane put it, that allow people to co-produce the policies that affect their everyday lives. For this next conversation with Hassan, I'm joined by Elsa Barron from the Center for Climate and Security, who was with both of these individuals and others at COP27 last year, where some of these conversations actually began. Elsa, thank you for joining.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
So before we jump into Hassan's interview, could you actually share some thoughts on COP27 and what youth engagement looked like there? I know that you were really involved in bringing youth together, so I'd love to hear some of your thoughts.
Yeah, I love that question. And I actually think there's a good argument for why COP27 was a potential turning point for youth engagement at high-level forums like this. As usual, there were a range of youth events in different pavilions and on different stages. But what was really unique about this COP in particular was that for the first time, there was a pavilion dedicated to children and youth themselves. And it was a hub for conversation and networking, and also a stage that provided a platform for young people to host events and to bring other speakers in to speak specifically to young people. And one of the moments on that stage that really stood out to me was when Prime Minister Mia Motley from Barbados, who is arguably a new celebrity at COP due to her Bridgetown agenda, which is kind of an economic proposal related to climate change and refinancing debt, came to the Children and Youth Pavilion, was up on the stage, and posed a pointed challenge to the young people there to both continue pointing out the gravity of the climate crisis and the injustices that are embedded within it, but also to really engage on actively building bridges to policymakers, practitioners, scientists, economists, you name it, to really shape the solutions we need. And the fact that we both need the critique and we need the solution, and you can't have one without the other.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think this idea of looking at how youth are both pushing for change and trying to critique solutions, but also trying to build solutions with existing policymakers and other stakeholders. I think that was the impetus for having these two conversations on this episode. And I think that this kind of balance is also really reflected in Christiane's interview. So, you know, on the one hand, she talks about what's not working and what could be working better. But on the other hand, she also talks about how to engage policymakers, how to build on policies that already exist, how to build on past successes. So it's this balance between gravity and hope.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. And I think that balance seems to be an emerging theme. And it's something that comes up in Hassan's interview as well, where he doesn't gloss over the years-long conflict that has plagued Somalia or extreme drought that's threatening pastoralists there, But, you know, he's also really excited to share about how youth activism has contributed to the creation of Somalia's Ministry of Environment and Climate Change last year, which is a massive success, and about how locally led adaptation projects are helping to save lives every day.
So we'll transition now to Hassan's interview. Hassan is based in Somalia. He's the co-founder and vice executive director of Somali Greenpeace Association, which is an NGO that educates people about climate change and advances sustainable development within Somalia. The organization is only 4 years old, but it has already reached more than 1,000 Somali youth. Hassan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. We're really thrilled to have you. You co-founded and lead an organization in Somalia, the Somali Greenpeace Association, that builds awareness around environmental issues, mobilizes young people in Somalia, and advocates for action at COP. And your interest in environmental leadership, from what I've read, was actually influenced by some of your own experiences with climate change. So could you start by sharing first what motivated you to create the Somali Greenpeace Association, and then share a bit about what the association is currently working on?
Thank you, Claire, for inviting me to this podcasting. I think it is a very moment to raise our voice and also tell to the world on what's happening on the ground. I co-founded Somali Greenpeace Association in 2019. And the result was the environmental awareness and climate change impacts needed by my community. As mentioned in several times, climate change impact and environmental degradation has impacted me directly. I have been working with community levels as I started my career in teaching young people and old people in basic education in literacy. It was during this time that the flash floods were frequently happening in the capital of Somalia. Although most of people were responding and organizations in humanitarian ways, but not seen into the length of climate change issues. In 2018, the frequent floods and drought that occurred in Somalia has led millions of people to get displaced and others to lose their properties. Such people included closest of my relatives who used to live at the rural areas, who are pastoralist background, and they were depending on the products of their animals. During these droughts, most of those animals died, and my closest relatives were no longer able to earn their livings. So in 2019, thinking on what actually can we do about was form an organization that speaks for the people of Somalia, for the grassroots communities, not in the sense of humanitarian response, but how they can become resilient and adaptable to the climate change. And my motivation behind was that when I took my first course from the UN Climate Change Learning Partnership Platform, that I learned from building community resilience through climate smart agriculture. And it was from this platform that I learned how climate change is impacting. And that was back on 2017. So through this education, it's that I have tried to replicate or transform this education to my community level and young people. So those are the things motivated me to form the organization, which now exists for 4 years.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that background and that story, Hassan. And I've been so grateful that I've been able to connect with you through various forums. And one of the most exciting ways that we got to collaborate this past year was at COP27, where we were part of a coalition of young people organizing events and interventions oriented around the themes of environmental peace building. And we were actually able to have a panel conversation in the Climate Registry Pavilion, where you and I were joined by a number of other youth actors on environmental peace building. We were also joined by a diverse global audience in the room. And one of the first things we did in that session was not jump immediately into the talking, but to step back and do an interactive activity where we asked people to map out their levels of hope and their levels of agency on an X and Y axis. And what I found really interesting, and you brought along a number of colleagues from Somalia, your home country, and I found it so interesting. A lot of the young people at COP said that they had high levels of agency. And that makes sense because most people are working on climate issues. And so they're already active and working in their communities. But what I found the most fascinating was that the young people who had come with you from Somalia were the only ones who mapped themselves as highly hopeful on the spectrum. And so I've been thinking about that ever since, in the months since that happened. And I think my question coming out of that is, when you work with and interact with young people in Somalia, you know, what are their concerns and what drives them forward? What gives them that hope that surpassed anyone else in the room? And kind of what do you see as the future they're working towards?
Thank you, Elsa. It is true that the young Somali people have higher hopes amongst those who participated in COP27. And the reason is that those young people, having been part of now the front lines in tackling climate change issues, environmental degradations, and peace building, they also see from the past experiences they had from the past 30 years that they were living in a state of conflict. They were living in a state affected by climate change impacts. They were living in a state where the environment was degraded. And now they were coming in a state of development where they could see that the future belongs to them. If I can highlight, the population of Somalia, 75% are youth. And this 75%, they are less than that at the age of that 5 years. So again, they see the strategic position Somalia lies, the potential resources which Somalia contains that has not been extracted. They see also they are the future leaders of Somalia. And having them coming in there, participating in COP27 was not just a chance that came. They had worked for it. They also, those young people whom you have seen, have managed to advocate the establishment of the Ministry of Environment of Climate Change for Somalia since ever, before it had not been there. So this is what it's driving them. So the concerns they have is high. Somalia is a country susceptible to conflict. As I speak now, just the previous 4 days, more than 100 people died due to conflict in a place called Las Anot, which is the northern part of Somalia. Most of those people who have passed away now or died as a result of such conflict are youth. So the one of the concerns is about peace. They want sustainable peace, which now they feel that they are not secure within their country. The other concerns we have as young people is the unemployment rate. Young people are unemployed in Somalia. So that's another concern. The other concern they have is about how they can compete with other young people in the world through education, through innovations. Apart from those concerns, there are something also driving them. The drivers is about the ambitions they have. They want to make a positive change in the country. This is one of the drivers. They also see that they can make change through education, through peace building. So what is driving them? What is driving them is also about their voices are heard by the politicians or policymakers. Because once they speak up, their voices are heard clearly and they might be responded, if not earlier, but later on.
Thank you, Hassan. And I'm glad that you shared about the context in Somalia as much as you did. I think that was really helpful, especially because many of our listeners may not know a lot about the Horn of Africa and the particular climate and conflict stressors that it's currently confronting. So you talked about droughts and floods. You talked about how that has triggered displacement. And then just now you talked about acute conflict and how that's impacted youth in particular. Could you tell us more about how conflict in Somalia is connected to environmental issues and why initiatives like the Somali Greenpeace Association are so important for both peace building and environmental progress or action?
Thank you, Claire. It's first, we need to clearly understand that climate change is impacting the livelihoods of the most vulnerable people, such as women and children. And this one is taking place where Somalian livelihoods lies, that is the agriculturist and the pastoralist. So during the drought seasons, the pastoralists try to move in search of pasture and water to other communal who might have such resources. And the other community sees this resource as inefficient to them. So when they come together, and there was already a history of maybe conflict between them. So during these drought seasons, when they come together, the point of resources is where that conflict emerges. We always say that climate change does not directly cause the insecurity, but it exacerbates the existing ones. So it is true, the environmental degradation is the shortage of water, the shortage of food, that everyone tries to fit and to become as the fittest, as we say, the stronger survivors in an environment where you need to survive it. So they try, it's about resource competitions. So it's through this thing which causing the problem. How is our initiative is important? Our initiative is about addressing the key issues. It's about training our new generations that climate change exists and it is real. It is training our new generations that we need to consume our resources sustainably. That it is our initiative that conveys the message that as much as we degrade our environment, our forest, that we are destroying part of our livelihoods. So it is through this initiative is that when we talk about the community level, that they either some of them listen and they take actions on the issue which exists. Such action has been taken within the capital where we advocated for a locally led climate action adaptation. Initially in that area, when flash floods occurs, people used to die. In 2021, almost 5 young people died near our district. So when we advocated the next year, the houses around and also the business around have started building or raising their building to upper ground so that when flash floods occurs, water does not seep into them. So on 2022, when the flash flood occurred, properties were not destroyed and livelihoods were not destroyed. So this is the kind of things our advocacy has improved. We only advocated, they have done the work by themselves. Other advocacy we do is that when we go to the grassroots levels where the farming occurs, we listen to them. And when we listen to them, they tell us the solutions they have, which is affordable to implement. It's through these solutions that we bring to the international forums that we tell them, you don't need to bring your solutions on the ground, but the people have the solutions. Can you finance them so that they implement these solutions? So this is why our initiative is important on the ground levels. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And I'm going to connect that to back up to what you said earlier about one of the reasons why young people have hope. I think you mentioned that they're able to reach policymakers and feel like there's a responsiveness. And I feel like that's really, really encouraging to hear. And as even as climate change exacerbates the conflict risk and exacerbates the current issues on the ground, if you have that really positive relationship with the governance system, I think it can build resilience to these crises as well. And that really leads into kind of the final question we have for you today, which is looking to the future, looking ahead. And given all of the fantastic work and advocacy that you and your organization and your community are doing on the ground and in communities that do have the solutions, as you mentioned, what are policymakers missing, or what insights or tools do you think can help this move this work forward? I know you mentioned finance. I know you mentioned listening to local issues and local solutions. But I'm curious if you see any gaps in existence that maybe the audience of this podcast can start to think about in terms of policy and how to make a difference in contexts like Somalia and beyond.
Thank you, Elsa. I think first we need to understand that there's already policies which exist. And such policies, when I read them, they are very beautiful. That they address the problems on the ground level issues. But the problem which has this policy is that they are not implemented. They are just on the table. So for our policy makers or politicians or those who have power or authority, if they could have implemented such policy, which is good for the community, because when I have gone through the policies already Somalia has developed, which now has been passed by the ministers just a week ago, those policies are very good. But what it needs is that it's about implementation. So in order also to implement that policies, you need to cooperate with civil society organizations, you need to cooperate with international donors, maybe if there's a gap of funding and financing. So it's all about implementation. We do have the policy, the tools and the policies are there. So there's no need for reforming or rewriting those policies, but it's about implementing those policies. Even as we see, like when we go to the international arena, the Paris Agreement, they are very beautiful. If those Paris Agreement could have been implemented now, we could have reached our goal of limiting the carbon emissions to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So it's about implementation. It's not about making the policy. The policy are there. Thank you.
So thank you, Hassan, for such a great conversation. I think that's also a really great way to end thinking about implementation and how to take what we already have and build on it. It's been sobering to hear about the many challenges, connected challenges in Somalia and the high toll that has taken on people on the ground. But it's also really eye-opening, at least for me, to hear about the work that you do, that your organization does, and how you approach enacting change, how you think about it. So thank you so much for all the work that you're doing and for sharing about it with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here, Hassan, and I can't wait for the next time we get to meet.
Thank you, both Elsa and Claire.
You've been listening to the new security broadcast at the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.